guess I've found some more big open-ended questions. Like, I've got one here. It says, can you comment on the seizure of power and its exercise in the U.S.? It's kind of a
big... Well, in terms of what has happened since the Constitution was written, of course, it's been the, how shall I put it, the disproof of the Federalist Number 10. Remember, Mr. Madison, James Madison, the Federalist Number 10 says, or he recognizes, he admits, that government tends to be nothing more than operation of special interest groups contending with each other. But if you have a large enough republic, what he calls the extended republic, and you have a sufficient number of these special interest groups, he called them factions, groups that are interested only in their own welfare or benefit, they're not interested in the common good, and therefore they have a certain anti-social aspect to them. But if you have a big enough system and enough of these groups contending, they will not be able to gain control of the governmental process. And somehow or other, they will blunt one another. Well, that's an interesting mechanical theory, but it leaves out the possibility that the special interest groups at some point in time will realize, as thieves do, that if they cooperate among themselves, and they may struggle back and forth for share of the pie, as it were, but if they cooperate among themselves in eating the pie, they can loot the rest of society. And that's essentially what's happened. So the government has become systematically infiltrated by these different groups, and each one has taken some portion of the state and national government's authority and used it for its own benefit. And the main engine of this has been, or is now, the banking and monetary system. And you can see that historically from the very beginning, that you had this pressure after the Constitution was enacted. Because you have to remember, going back to the colonial period, the colonies generated what they call bills of credit, which were paper money. And this was a way for politicians to spend without having to tax. Of course, they also had the problem then they didn't have a great deal of specie money, actual gold and silver coin in the colony. That ended up in a disastrous situation in the War of Independence, because not only the Continental Congress, but most of, if not all of the states were generating paper money, which was imprudent, let's call it that way, couldn't possibly be redeemed, because all these bills of credit promised to pay in a certain amount of gold or silver. So the Federal Convention, having seen this experience, and in fact, most of the people in the Federal Convention had been in one way or another connected with the Continental Congress or the various state governments, they had actually been the ones who were responsible for this hyperinflationary event during the War of Independence. They strictly limited both the states and the national government in the ability to generate currency. They took away from the states the power to coin money or to emit bills of credit. They didn't give a power to emit bills. It was proposed, but they didn't give it. That's the fascinating thing. It was explicitly proposed in the Constitutional Convention to give the what they called the general government, we call today the federal government, the general government, the Washington, D.C. government, to give that government the power to emit bills of credit, that is to create paper money. And they voted that down. They left only the power to coin money in Congress. And that was understood to be a power to coin gold and silver, go into the history of the thing, what the Continental Congress had done and so forth and so on. But that was the structure. There was to be no governmental paper money. There was to be no, what we call today, monetization of debt. So the first instruments that appeared, the financial community devised the idea of a national bank. And they created two of them, the First Bank of the United States. That charter was not renewed, and then there was a Second Bank of the United States, and that resulted in what's called a bank fight with President Jackson. Simultaneously, there were a number of banks that were created in the states. And most of those went with the ups and downs of fractional reserve banking. You had recurrent they call financial panics or financial stringencies, because the system's unstable. But it was useful for an interface of the politicians and the financial class, if you will. It was this kind of natural symbiosis between the two, politically speaking. Well, the Jacksonians were against that, and in fact, there was an actual separation of bank and state, if you will, prior to the Civil War. The government operated its financial affairs through the Treasury Department and what they call the sub-treasury system. There's treasury offices in different parts of the country. They didn't use banks at all. The Civil War showed up, and there was a great, stringency, tremendous expenditures, the unwillingness of the private banks to lend money to the Union government. Focus on that one. That one ended up coming out of the war successfully. So the Union Congress panicked and enacted the first paper money law that this country had seen since the War of Independence, February of 1862. And these were so-called greenbacks, legal tender paper currency generated by the government. They printed these things and used them to pay for war expenditures, essentially. and that was the great break at that point because of the war. Now, in 1863, they then generated a corresponding statute for the banking system called the National Currency Act. And this created national banks, and it's actually still part of the law. And the national banks could buy treasury bonds and then deposit those with the Secretary of the Treasury. And 90% of the face value of those bonds, they could generate their own paper currency, so-called national bank currency. So this was a way to monetize governmental debt. So you had those two new elements that developed during the Civil War: the direct generation of paper currency by the Treasury, and this indirect generation through a banking cartel, because that's essentially what the national banks were, the way the thing was structured, on the basis of governmental debt, monetization of governmental debt. Now, that didn't stop the problems of fractional reserve banking. You had a whole series of ups and downs, financial panics. And it was also limited because it depended upon constantly increasing the size of the governmental debt, because the currency was tied directly to the amount of governmental debt that was out there. And during the latter part of the 19th century, there was lack of enthusiasm, shall we say, for having massive governmental debts. But on the other side of the coin, there were these continuous bank crises because they couldn't solve the problem of fractional reserve banking. And that was the genesis of the Federal Reserve System. Thinking of a way to deal with this problem of fractional reserve banking, they thought the answer was, well, we will create a central banking structure, and there will be a, quote, lender of last resort. So when these banks down below in the pyramid become imprudent and they overexpand the currency, and there are essentially runs on them because people have lost confidence in them, then the lender of last resort will be able to come in and essentially bail them out. That's not the wording they used in those days, but that's the reality. And this was touted as a scientific way to manage money and to end depressions and all the hoopla that went along with it. And it was actually the real plan in the background was to tie very closely the banking community, high finance, with the government. And in fact, if you read the legislative history, that is the debates in Congress, when the National Currency Act was up, and there were two of them, actually, 1863, and then they reenacted 1864. And then the the Federal Reserve Act, which superseded the National Currency Act. That's the argument that's made by the proponents. They say, well, we have to create an alliance here between the people in high finance, the Wall Street types, if you will, and the Treasury of the government, so we can stabilize the economic system. And, of course, there was a hidden leitmotif in there so that we can maintain the power of the political party structure, right? Because that was the quid pro quo. So in any event, they create the Federal Reserve System in 1913, interestingly enough, just in time to finance America's involvement in World War I. These things happened so coincidentally. It was supposed to stabilize the monetary system, end depressions. 1921, 1922, they had a depression right away, right after the war. Then you had massive expansion. 1929 through 32 was the collapse of the stock market and the banking system. That should have been the proof to anybody of the unworkability of this system, 1932. The Federal Reserve had a 40 requirement, statutory requirement, of a 40% gold backing on its currency. And notwithstanding that, they overexpanded. Banks collapsed in 32, and instead of the political class saying, oh, well, this proves the fractional reserve banking is essentially unworkable and we have to reform that system, Roosevelt comes in, Franklin D., seizes gold from the American people, essentially bailing out the banks, as none of the banks don't have to pay their obligations, and actually expanded the power of the Federal Reserve System. And that was the first step in the direction of a fiat currency, because all of these paper currencies from 1862 on had been redeemable in silver or gold or both. The U.S. Treasury notes, they weren't redeemed during the war because they didn't pay out gold and silver during the war, but after the war, they were redeemed in silver or gold, and the Federal Reserve notes were redeemed in gold. So Roosevelt comes in, he takes the first step by removing gold from the system, at least domestically. They still paid it out internationally, but actually during the 30s and the 40s, the gold was flowing into this country. After the war, World War II, there was a massive expansion of Federal Reserve notes and bank credit. And as a result of that, a huge amount, about 50% of the U.S. gold stock, went overseas to pay, to redeem Federal Reserve notes held by foreigners. Tremendous outflow. One wonders exactly who benefited from that. You can't find any records. I have seen records as to which central banks in different countries overseas received gold, but on whose behalf they were acting and who ended up holding the gold. I don't know where those records, anybody even really maintained them. But in any event, about 50% of the gold stock in the United States, which is the largest gold stock the world had ever seen, as far as I know, it was drained away by this inflationary policy. A lot of it during the Johnson era, Vietnam War era, the guns and butter policy of Lyndon Johnson. So that by 1971, Nixon, President Nixon, in August of that year, decided enough was enough, and he terminated redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold anywhere. They hadn't been redeemable in the United States domestically, and after August of 71, they were no longer redeemable internationally. So the Federal Reserve note at that time was almost a fiat currency. Not quite, because we still had silver circulating in the economy. There was silver coinage circulating, and there were U.S. notes, these greenbacks, and silver certificates. So it was conceivable that you could take a Federal Reserve note and you could exchange it for a U.S. note, and then you could exchange it for a silver certificate, and eventually you could get your hands on a dollar's worth of silver, 371 and a quarter grains of silver. That, however, went on only, the Johnson administration actually stopped that before Nixon. That went on only until 1968. 68, silver was removed from the system domestically and internationally. 71, they stopped the international payment of gold. So at that point, you ended up with Federal Reserve notes were redeemable in nothing but base metallic coinage, because they were still generating out of the Treasury the copper nickels, the sandwich coins. So technically, I guess, Federal Reserve notes are not a true fiat currency, because conceivably, you can convert them as a matter of law into these base metallic coins. Now, the peculiarity of the system, but it's pretty close, let me put it that way, it's pretty close to the fiat system. And the effect of that is that they can essentially